Accession number 30493, Reel 6.
I'm not sure that answers your question about the technical matter. As I say, I wasn't trained to on the mathematical side, but at least I've described the process that went on all the time between the observation posts and the and us on the guns.
What effect on the crew's hearing did the guns have?
Hearing? Ah, yes, well, it might explain why I'm deaf today. I've got two hearing aids. You see, we were issued with those little rubber things you put in your ears, and they were on a string, and they hung around your neck. And I only use them half the time. You know, you are in when you're young, you're stupid about that, things like that. You see building workers using pneumatic drills without proper protection for their ears. It's crazy, of course. I think the big construction workers are more demanding that they wear protective devices now on building sites. But and the same in the army. The army said, come put these in your ears when you're on the gun. But you didn't most of the time. Now, the impact of a 25-pound of firing, it's not all that great, really. It's a sort of crack. It's not like if you're close to a mortar, you really put your hands over your ears, you know. But there's a level of gunfire that's going on. I came across passages in my diary where there's a real thunder of guns going on. And there's one particular I came across where the shells seemed to be flying in all directions. You didn't know which were the enemy and which were your fellow gunners. After they're about... You had the light field gun, and then you had the 25-pound. It was very adaptable and could go anywhere. Then you had the 105mm gun, and then you had the heavy gun and the medium guns. And when they were all firing at once, it was just horrendous. It was all hell let loose. And as I say over and over again, how the hell do those Germans continue to defy us, not run? But they were so skilled at digging in, you know. They built one defensive line after another, all the way up Italy, labelled them the Gustav line. We had to try and penetrate the Gustav line. But then when they left it, they moved into another one, the Hitler line. They had all Hitler line. And there were lines like that all the way up it. They're all ready, prepared for them to drop into. And we were pouring tons and tons of steel and bombs on positions that couldn't... Well, if they kept their heads down, they survived. The pummeling that must have been horrendous. And I mean... deaf Germans that they are today. They must be great men still. So, as well as deaf ex-gunners in Britain.
Did you have anything in the way of small arms training while you were in Yorkshire?
It's the first thing you do. I mean, I think I don't know whether everybody, but I'm sure today, surely, everybody... whether you're going to be a signaller or a batman or a gunner, whatever position you are in the army, you must surely be ready to use small arms in some crisis position, you know, when you're overrun. There was always a danger we were... In fact, it was a great fear. I used to feel quite severely fearful about been overrun, but nevertheless, we would. The first thing we do is bayonet. I mean, there were no. there was almost no weapons to train on when we arrived on the Salisbury Plain. So we were issued with rifles and bayonets, and that was it. So we had these straw dummies to charge, and we were taught to shout, just like First World War soldiers were, kill, 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 and you plunge your steel into the enemy and twist it and withdraw it and retreat and then charge again. Oh, but there we are, you're being taught basic defence with a rifle and bayonet. Now, the next thing was grenades. These were alarming things. You had to pull out the safety pin. You had to go forward with it, lay flat, pull out the safety pin, and then throw it ahead of you and kick your head down. I mean, these were live grenades. And there was always some idiot who got nervous. I don't think anybody died. But there were always somebody nervous enough not and sort of had to be nursed through that experience. And then light machine gun, well, we didn't get that far, but the Bren came later, and the Tommy gun, the kind Churchill was photographed with, and Hitler made great use of that photograph. Churchill, the gunman, the gangster, but we had the Tommy guns issued, and just now and again there'd be a threat of enemy penetration, and we had to work out some sort of defence system. If there was an alarm, we'd grab our rifles or Tommy guns. So the only Tommy gun I had was when I was in the observation post. I've got a photo of myself with it in the rubble. I don't remember firing one, but we were given one to defend ourselves if the Germans attacked this observation post. But happily, just in front of us, there were half a dozen Indian soldiers whose job was to defend us to the end. And every observation post had a little group of infantry from the Indian infantry to protect it. Their job was to protect us and all die in the attempt. So they were brave people, brave. Oh, cannon fodder. They were cannon fodder. Indian infantry. It's absolutely disgraceful that proper respect and hasn't been paid to the mass of Indians who died fighting for king and country. Why should they fight for king and country, for God's sake? Garhwalis, Punjabis, Sikhs. Oh, there we were. That's it. They were the people we were supporting. There were two English regiments, infantry regiments, but all the others were Indians. 10th Indian Division, but they were mountain people. They really knew how to fight in the mountains, and the Jerrys did fear them because they were quite ruthless when they got into action, and they liked to use their steel, their kukris, the Gurkha and his kukri. It was greatly feared. It's a horrible curved weapon, quite short. It was used to great effect. They were very good at sneaking up on the Germans and bringing back prisoners. In fact, I came across a passage in the diary that we had to support a unit of Garhwali that was sent out to capture prisoners. The capture of prisoners was part of our job because, I mean, we didn't do it, but of course we had to ready to support the Indians who would go out. The sole purpose was to capture Germans in order to extract information from them. That was vital for the war. And I'd given an account of a group going out, and they come back. They were three prisoners. They killed three and captured three, and they're back safe and sound. And all we did was drop some smoke bombs. Now, it's interesting, I report that in my diary, And I say to myself, it's difficult to visualise what's happening now. We fired the smoke, and then I say, now the smoke swirling round the target, round the house, or wherever the Germans have been spotted. The Gawalis go in, tip-toeing through the smoke, hoping not to be detected. Yeah. They grab a couple of Germans, and then they get out, you know. Do they need our help? Do they need rounds? No. No message comes up. And then over the loudspeaker, it comes, prisoners captured, you know. Patrol returns. All very dramatic. But, so you really got involved at times like that. Because the war became sort of, you know, one very narrow little episode in which you were involved. I think that's what... There we are. There's a certain attraction. As well as the nasty side of it.
What was the gunner's uniform?
Sorry?
What was the gunner's uniform?
The gunner's uniform, just the rules as everybody else's. I mean, when you see soldiers today with all that armour and gear they carry around, I mean, for God's sake, we fought a war in a khaki twill and a steel hat. And look at those photos of the 8th Army in North Africa. There they are with their advancing with their rifles and their bayonets and their tin hats. And their little khaki shorts and trousers and boots and socks. And you compare it with the soldiers today, the way, you know, they're so fearsome of casualties. I mean, they always fear the political fallout of any action. They're thinking about, will it affect my vote? The politicians are saying, if so many men die, you know. So let's protect the soldiers, you know, send them out more armour and all kinds of gadgets. So, but I'm sure they become less effective soldiers with all that gear, really. It may be comforting, I suppose, psychologically. In the diary I described, as we came out from the observation post, there was a British group of soldiers. They were going in at night to capture prisoners. This was a British unit, infantry unit. And they had their faces blacked and a woolly hat on and their rifle and nothing else, you know, and then a basic uniform. We just had a serge uniform, that was all that was issued. I mean, when we relieved the Americans, we just could not believe the quality of their uniform, the smartness of it, how different we were. Us in our shabby serge and our silly little steel helmet there with their snug steel helmets and their... the quality of everything, the food they had. We relieved them, so we were with them for about 24 hours while their guns left the pits, the gun pits, and our guns went into the pit, and we sort of watched each other's operations very closely, watching what level of efficiency each side was. And then we had breakfast, and we had, you know, choice of eggs and bacon and sausages and grits, I think they called them. I just could not believe that this kind of food could be served up on a battlefront. Let's talk about a spoilt army. Really, and to this day, it is a spoilt army. And you don't get good soldiers by spoiling them, I'm sure. No. It seems stupid to talk this way because, you know, I'm against war and I'm against conflict. And I want peace, I want talk. Churchill said, jaw is better than war, and that's the most sensible thing Winston Churchill ever said. Jaw is better than war. What wise words. But who listens to them? The politicians squabble, and the generals squabble, and the men die, and the civilians die, by the 100,000. Horrible. That's my true belief estimation. Very angry about it, really, ever since 1945.
For how long were you in Yorkshire?
Back to Yorkshire. Well, when I remember visiting York, which is very, I remember being thrilled by a visit to York, visiting the city, a lovely old city, and walking around the walls. I don't remember very much about Yorkshire, you know. I just remember the drilling, the exercises on the moors, the how tough it was actually, on one of the exercises in the weather, terrible weather. And the fact that we had to, as I say, be spick and span at the end of it all. I don't remember. No, it's all gone, you know. And if I look in my diary, it's all very sparse while we were in Britain. I could probably tell you which films I was seeing at the time.
Once the training had finished, then, where did you go next?
The bigger bit, of course, was Churchill visiting us suddenly. I think I told you about that. Now, that you know, that was great morale boost, there's no doubt about that. He certainly knew what he was doing, winning in the war. And then we were posted to Watford. Now, we were trained soldiers waiting for to be thrown into the war. So, of course, training went on, marching, endless marching on the parade ground, honestly. I mean, they got nothing else for you to do. They'd set you marching up and down, drilling, saluting, endless guards. And of course, guard duty was a part of a soldier's life. You always had guard duties everywhere. And so you had your turn almost every week, I suppose. You had to be spick and span for that. And you hopefully you would be chosen as best man, which meant you just stayed in your bed and just had fetch tea and cocoa for the rest, but didn't have to actually do any, and didn't have to get up in the night. But I don't think I was ever best man in Britain. I once or twice in Italy later on. I was never that smart enough. My badges didn't glisten quite, or my toe caps, they didn't quite glisten as much as the next guy, you know. So, Watford. Now, well, the good thing about Watford is that sort of there'd be a lot of physical training, there'd be sports, there was a swimming pool we could use, there was a good cinema, I think I went to my first music concert, and it was some famous pianist, oh dear. I can't think of his name. I suppose that was the first time I'd gone to a concert of serious music. I remember enjoying that. That was a sort of landmark, I suppose. Swimming. Then, one thing I remember is we used to go on a run, and some PT instructor would take us out, and he'd make the mistake of running us through the park, and every now and again one or two of us would dive off into the bushes and then we were never missed, you know. We just went off into the town. That was the sort of bolshy mood I think we were beginning to get to develop. We'd find the little loopholes in the discipline, you know, which the soldier does. It's extraordinary how you learn to bend the rules, even a little bit. You seize the opportunity. Your life is so structured. Every morning for 7 years, I had to read a notice on the board, last thing at night, to see what all planned out for us the next day. It's so corrupting, really. You know, all your movements next day have all been planned ahead, you know. You've always been doing what you've been told to do. That turned me into a sort of a rebel. I think most soldiers became sort of residual rebels under that discipline and routine and boredom. So at Watford, well, there we are. We knew we were all going to be posted. The air was full of rumours. We were going here, there, and everywhere, all over the world. Usually not a lot of nonsense. Now, at least from there, we were allowed to go home occasionally. I lived in Brighton, or near Brighton, Portswade, in Sussex, next to Hove, between Hove and Southwick. And it only took an hour and a half to get there from Watford. So I got official leave once or twice, just for weekend leave. And then once I was so fed up, I thought, oh, for hell, I've got no duties this weekend. I'll try to get home without a pass. I don't know whether I've told you the story, did I, before? Anyway, I jumped on a train, got to Brighton, and I think I told you the story. The Red Cap intercepted me, and of course I was on a charge. But he looked at my pay book, took the particulars, but then he said, okay, mate, off you go, and let me go home, you know, instead of sending me back on the train to London. I'm very grateful to that Red Cap. Usually they have a very bad reputation in the army. They're tough disciplinarians and love to book you. This guy...
Were there consequences later, though?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was on a charge, marched before my officer, by the sergeant major. Quick march, left, right, stop, halt, blah, blah. Tap off. Well, great. I hear you went off to home this weekend. Yes, sir. Without a pass. Yes, sir. Why did you do that? Homesick, sir. Just report to the sergeant major tonight, will you? He'll find you something to do. And that was it. You know, I was put on some idiotic task by the sergeant major that night. Probably helping in the cookhouse or something like that. No. a small price to pay for a weekend at home. So there we are. Watford was a waiting period. There again, you see all the guys. Some of them were from all over. Some of them had moved me in Yorkshire, and there we all were trained gunners from different units, and some of us stayed together where we were posted to the Middle East. So one day the order came through that we were we weren't told any information, I don't think, at all. We weren't told where we were going. It's an enormous amount of speculation. So this date was given and we were put on a troop train and went overnight across Britain and Scotland, and ended up in the port in the north, the embarkation port. So that was the end of training in Britain. Fully trained, I suppose we're all raring to go, really. Because the news is still pretty bad from all over the world. It wasn't until Russia came into the war, see, when Hitler and Stalin... Hitler broke all his promises to Stalin. And Stalin was naive to have believed Hitler. And Stalin disbelieved his spies. He had marvellous spies all over the world. I mean, there was a chap called Sergei, a German... And he was a secret communist, and he masqueraded as a journalist. Well, he was a journalist, but he masqueraded as a Nazi journalist, Lord to the Führer. And he was a very good journalist, and he was posted off to Tokyo to liaise with the Japanese fascists, and he reported to his newspaper. But in all the time, he was so out and out pro-fascist, pro-Hitler, that he was accepted on the highest levels, and he got up to an intimate of the emperor of Japan, and from him, a prince somebody, it's all on the record now, he obtained the actual date of Hitler's proposed attack on the Soviet Union. And he had a network of agents. It's an amazing story, the Sorge story. The way he was accepted in these Nazi circles is so convincing, and he was a totally dedicated communist. And he got the report through. He had a very loyal radio man who got it through on the spy network, and it reached Stalin. It's known to have reached Stalin, and he ignored it. There was also, I think, a report from a Polish agent who also reported that he discovered this. Hitler was about to launch an attack. So Stalin ignored all those warnings, and he even gave orders that if the Soviet forces saw German aircraft overhead, they were not to fire at it. So all the air drones on which the Soviet Air Force was all lined up, they had order straight from Joseph Stalin, commander-in-chief, not to fire on German planes. So when the German planes came in, they just wiped out the Red Air Force on the ground, It's terrible to begin into the war. Well, at least it brought Russia into the war. And with its multi-million population, you knew that you had a very valuable ally indeed. And Churchill didn't waste any time, and he was embraced his comrade Stalin. there's a supper talk for you. And we all followed suit. Joe Stalin became our... We were all rooting for Joe Stalin for a couple of years, I can tell you. The only victories were coming from the first of all, the terrible defeats. The retreat of the Red Army, that was horrendous, frightening. Right up to the gates of Moscow, Leningrad, Stalingrad. Will they hold out? That was 1942. All of 42 was, will the Russians hold out in Moscow, Leningrad? All that came through to the army, day by day. You can't imagine it today, what it was like to know that the Russian army was on the run and embattled. God, if Hitler could capture Russia with its endless wealth, oil, coal, steel, and a whole nation enslaved by the Nazis. Anybody with any imagination in 1942 was rooting for the Red Army, I can tell you, including us.